Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
Brexit.
My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country.
For the latter period of the Brexit crisis, John Bercow became one of the most visible and powerful politicians in the UK, which is highly unusual for someone inhabiting the position of the Speaker of the House of Commons, and definitely for someone, or at least a Member of Parliament, who has as many detractors as they have friends.
Order! Order!
We'll leave it there for now, and I hope there are no further points of order. There's an Arsenal match on television very soon.
Today I speak to Sebastian Whale, who has written an autobiography about the man who showed the real power that the Speaker wields in Parliament and who rallied the opposition to Brexit and showed the power of Parliament in the face of the executive. Hello, Sebastian. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Not too bad. We did just say we're both good sons and that in this apocalyptic time, we've decided to come to the aid of our parents. So who's the better son? It's probably me because I come further than you. You're in Leamington Spa, aren't you?
I mean, I got on a train about, you know, an hour's journey. You came from San Francisco, so I think you win on this game of Top Trumps.
I should do a radio link here now, shouldn't I, and say John Bercow was the son of a taxi driver of Jewish parentage. What's the most remarkable thing about John Bercow? Is it the fact that potentially he has strengthened and shaped the position of the Speaker of the House of Commons, or is it his political journey from right-wing fringes to soft, cuddly, centrist liberal?
Well, I think it's all part of the same one. I think the overarching thing is the journey, because it did lead to him end up, you know, being the bastion of the Commons and its defender in many ways. And, you know, lots of people go on political journeys, but they tend to be from the left to the right. That's the more cliche, stereotypical journey that people go on. But John Bercow did the opposite of that. And I would say he had the most fascinating journey of anyone in contemporary modern politics, and certainly in the UK. And studying it and looking into why that was the case was one of the most fascinating things I've ever done in my life, to be honest with you.
It sounds like a very obvious question, but why did you decide that you need to write a book about him, and why now?
The idea came from my editor. I work for the House magazine as political editor. The House magazine is the UK's weekly publication, so it gets distributed to every MP here. And it was his idea. He was researching it for reasons known only to himself. He was researching him on the weekend, and then he texted me at about 9 o'clock on a Saturday night and said, you should write a book on John Bercow. And in my day job, I write profiles of MPs and interview them. And I've always been fascinated by John Bercow, and he's always been the key figure ever since I've been sort of politically conscious, which was about when I went to university. So I went in 2009 and he became a speaker then. So he's been an omnipresent figure in my sort of political journey of my own, to be honest with you. And he's just such a fascinating guy. You know, I didn't necessarily have that many preconceptions about him as a person or about his character. I had, you know, perceptions. I thought, you know, he could show some signs of bias. I thought he could be prone to anger. But equally, I thought he was absolutely box office and one of the most entertaining figures in British politics and indeed in public life. Naturally, he was just a fascinating person to study. And then when you look into him and you learn about his early life, some of his challenges there, he was quite badly bullied, difficult, complicated upbringing with his parents and from fairly humble beginnings as well. through to his days on the student right of conservative politics, you know, more Thatcherite than Thatcher, through to the kind of torch-bearing liberal that we know today. So as I looked into that, saw some of the contradictions, things that didn't ostensibly make sense at first before you got to know him. And I just thought, I have to do this book because it's just such an incredibly interesting journey and such a fascinating story.
So you worked for Politics Home, you now work for The House. So you are, you kind of know politicians, don't you? You know Parliament, you know how it works, you know the personalities around that kind of famed institution. Why is it that Burko, much beloved by, let's say, people outside of the House of Commons, why did he have so many detractors within?
It's an excellent question. I think a lot of it can come down to perception, because I think there is a perception of John Burko in the public, and there's a perception of John Burko from those who know him personally, and often those can differ, because I spoke to a few journalists from Italy, Portugal, the United States, and their perception of John Burko is this as this eccentric, slightly verbose but very entertaining character who defended, you know, the Commons against the bully boys in government, and that's mm-hmm. is one perception of John Burko. There's another perception where he doesn't have fantastic interpersonal skills. You know, he's wonderfully articulate and entertaining in the House of Commons chamber, but behind the scenes he can be quite abrupt. He can be, as I say, prone to anger. So there's a different perceptions between the, you know, perhaps what the perceived reality is and the reality. That's not to say that he's not, you know, he has plenty of friends and people who would say, you know, good things about him. Equally, as we know, with some of the bullying allegations against him, there is also another side to John Burko, which those who have worked alongside him for many years have experienced. And that's why I think there's a slight disconnect between the public perception, which, you know, is often favourable, particularly in the last couple of years on Brexit, depending on what side of the ledger you find yourself, if you're a Remainer or a Leaver. He hasn't necessarily accumulated that many friends. And I think part of that is just the nature of being a successful politician, is that often mm-hmm. you will have upset a few people along the way. That is just the way that these things go. And part of that is because he has a personality that is divisive. And he says that, you know, he says that, I know I can be somewhat divisive as a character in how I handle myself. But he is incredibly honest. And yeah, and I think that's why there's a slight disconnect between those two perceptions.
Mm. All right. So let's wind all the way back to the teenage John Burko. He's pretty smart. He doesn't go to a grammar school or anything like that, but he ends up being part of the kind of right wing group who are kind of aligned to, but at the fringes of the Tory party. Tell us all about that and let's start his political journey.
The key character in terms of his political journey is his dad, who was a mm-hmm. big fan of, among other people, Enoch Powell. Now, obviously, Enoch Powell, we now know and think of famously for his Rivers of Blood speech in 1968 and some of his highly divisive, well, frankly, racist proclamations in that regard.
In 15 or 20 years' time, the black man will have the whip hand over the white man. Well, I can already hear the chorus of execration. How dare I say such a horrible thing? How dare I stir up trouble and inflame feelings by repeating such a conversation? My answer is that I do not have the right not to do so.
At the time, obviously, that Rivers of Blood speech was very controversial, but he was ultimately a mainstream politician and he was popular amongst a certain cohort of people, one of whom was John Burko's dad. Now, he passed on that passion for Enoch Powell's politics, because Enoch Powell was an incredible orator, you know, notwithstanding everything in between. He was, you know, a very powerful politician, one who could deliver great speeches, great affectations, all this kind of thing. And I think he was quite an alluring figure. And so Burko was inspired towards the right, but largely due to sort of his father. And he would, you know, he was a very precocious Burko. He used to read the Times newspaper at the age of about 10. And discuss the politics of the day with the parents of his friends and things like that. So he was well ahead of the curve, as you can probably imagine. As a teenager, he was pretty right wing, and then he grew up. You know, his formative years were during the 1974 to 1979 Parliament, when you had a hung Parliament, and then there was all sorts of things with the winter of discontent, and basically, you know, the UK wasn't in a great position at that point in time, and that was formative because he thought, well, this doesn't look right to me. So when Margaret Thatcher came along, he was like, yes, I this is a bit of me, this, you know, that kind of more almost libertarian outlook in terms of personal responsibility, backing business, low taxation, that kind of thing. He was fully signed up to that, you know, from 16, 17, 18. Mm-hmm. Naturally, as someone who admired Enoch Powell, he also was quite authoritarian when it came to immigration. So after he left school, he joined a group called the Monday Club, which is affiliated to the Conservative Party. Now, at the time, thought of as a pretty right-wing organization, particularly in this era. And they believed in the repatriation of immigrants back to their countries. They felt that the UK could not sustain the levels of immigration that it was seeing at that point in time, both from a public services standpoint and also just from a sort of social cohesion standpoint, which was Burko's main thing. So despite being the grandson of a Romanian Jew, Burko was anti-immigration, which is one of those contradictions that I discussed earlier. So he found himself in the Monday Club, and he was a member of it for 3 years, active 18 months, and he was even a secretary on the Immigration and Repatriation Committee. So he was fully signed up to these views, and then he says that he sort of left figuratively after 18 months when he realized that he was actually surrounded by some relatively unpleasant people with some unpleasant views. And it's one of those things that has very much not haunted him, but you can tell in his personal discussions about his early political beliefs that he is somewhat, as he said himself, he's ashamed. It's his words, not mine. He's ashamed of those days. And I think you need to consider his liberal shift with that in mind. I think his liberal shift is sincere, don't get me wrong. And I think it's well evidenced across two decades, at least. I think part of it is motivated by an awakening to just how wrong he perceived his previous views to have been. And so he's in some way not compensating, but almost trying to make up for those early beliefs. And that's to be probably, you know, applauded, if anything, because if you start on the wrong side of the argument, you end up on the right one. And that's the journey is a good one, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's just a very interesting thing to consider. It's definitely a formative part of John Burko's journey, that those early days in the Monday Club is something that really stand out as important to what happened subsequently as well.
Our only hope is to be able to get away from Southall, away from it all. Like everybody else, all our friends have gone. There's nothing left for English people in this town anymore. I would like to say this. My wife and I used to like to go out weekends down to the local, have a couple of drinks, meet friends in there. We can't go into the locals anymore. They're full up with noisy foreigners, and we don't like it.
We don't like it.
We haven't got a place left which we, the English people, can go and enjoy ourselves in this town.
After going through two world wars, we should at least have the dignity of being allowed to live with our own kind.
I don't know, ask a really naive question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. His grandfather was a Romanian Jew. When he emigrated to Britain, he changes the family surname from Berkowitz to Burkow, so it sounds anglicized. So his father was a practicing Jew. His mother converted to Judaism. Did he just forget he was Jewish? Did he forget that actually he was from immigrant stock? Was it, or was this a case of, well, we are white? Immigrants back then were seen as non-white. We're not talking about early 21st century waves of Eastern European immigration into the UK. How could he square that as soon as he walked into that organisation?
That's an excellent question. That's not a naive question at all. I think there's various complications within that. You are right that his mother converted to Judaism when she married Charles Burko. And there are some schools of thought where, because Jewishness is passed on matrilineally through the mother, that to some quote-unquote authentic Jews, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way, I just mean to some people who believe in that kind of, that lineage has to be there, John Burko wasn't quite Jewish. And to others, to non-Jews, he was Jewish. And so he found himself in this kind of halfway house where a sense, you know, in terms of belonging to a community or a group, he was sort of denied that in a way.
Mm.
In terms of why he went for this anti-immigration approach, I think an interesting aspect of that could be that as a descendant of a Romanian immigrant, perhaps he felt, admittedly second generation, he could have espoused on the rights of other people to belong in Britain, he felt more British himself, if that makes sense.
Mm.
He felt that he'd earned the right to kind of talk about who else could belong, and it gave him a sense of belonging in surrounding himself with these people. Because, as I say, he kind of found himself slightly in limbo where he didn't necessarily fit in with certain groups. And I think he found this authoritarian genre of politics, particularly after being bullied and ostracized as a teenager, quite appealing. But it's a very valid question, though, how someone with his background ended up with such a hard line on immigration, because it is ostensibly, you know, as you say, at that point, particularly in the 1980s, you obviously had Windrush, the Windrush generation, you know, a decade or so earlier as well. So it would have been largely, you know, influx of based on colour that you had problems with. So
people like me.
Indeed. And, you know, the notion, you know, us talking about this, you know, if John Burko was, say, a third window in this conversation, he'd be mortified.
Mm.
You know, he would be mortified that we were talking about this in these terms. And I think that is absolutely sincere. I just think a series of events in his life of not really belonging anywhere or not fitting in led him to a group that very much are only certain people can sit with us kind of thing. I think that kind of appealed to it. But it's a fascinating aspect of his character.
So in the early 80s, he sees the light and realizes that there are a whole bunch of unpleasant racists. He goes to university. Let's try and fill in the time between the early 80s and him becoming a councillor and then an MP. Give us the lay of the land, because surely politically, in terms of understanding how politics really works as opposed to the theory of politics, these must have been formative years for him. So let's go through that period before he becomes an MP.
Breath for that favourite media catchphrase, the U-turn. I have only one thing to say. U-turn if you want to. The ladies, not for turning.
Be pleased to inform Her Majesty that the White Ensign flies alongside the Union Jack in South Georgia. God save the Queen.
What happens next? What is the nod?
Thank you very much.
What's your reaction?
Just rejoice at that news and congratulate our forces and the Marines. President of the Commission, Mr. Delors, said at press conference the other day that he wanted the European Parliament to be the democratic body of the community. He wanted the Commission to be the executive, and he wanted the Council of Ministers to be the Senate. No. Yeah. No. Yeah. No. Levels of income are better off than they were in 1979. But what the honourable member is saying is that he would rather the poor were poorer, provided the rich were less rich. That way you will never create the wealth for better social services as we have. And what a policy! Yes, he would rather have the poor poorer, provided the rich were less rich. That is a liberal policy.
And we're very happy that we leave the United Kingdom in a very, very much better state than when we came here 11 and a half years ago.
So university was probably the happiest time of John Burko's early years. He talks effusively about his experience. So he went to Essex University and he studied government. There he very much got involved with conservative student politics, as you can imagine. But Essex at the time was a hotbed of sort of left-wing activism. they had some, there was a miners' strike nearby, and they had some of the miners come and, you know, some of them put miners in their dormitories and things like that. So Burke was very much on the in the minority in that sense, but that didn't stop him. You know, he was fantastically brave, frankly. He used to give sort of these conservative sermons in the square in the university, where he would just be baited by people on the left. He once had a pint poured over him by a left-wing activist who didn't like what he was saying. But he was, I think he was, you know, he's brave. It was obviously, he took some balls, frankly, to take on what was a quite a hostile environment for conservatives like him. So that was very formative. But at the same time, he was involved with a group called the Federation of Conservative Students. Now, the Federation of Conservative Students was, again, affiliated with the Conservative Party. They were given a grant by the party every year. And it was a big 14,000 or so strong group of student activists. Now, obviously, at this point, so Burke was 1982 to 1985, where his student years. At this point as well, you have militant and the rise of the left. At the same time, so you had quite a brash, forthright form of politics going on the left, and the Federation of Conservative Students very much matched them for that. They would picket various events. They would, like, for example, Burke went down to a Labour Party conference to sort of heckle people from outside of the secure zone and things like that. So he sort of learned that confrontational approach to politics, and also how to take on the left and try and counter their narratives. So this was, again, very formative. And Burke went on to chair this body, the Federation of Conservative Students. Now, in what I find fascinating is in this group, the Federation of Conservative Students, there were also people such as Robbie Gibb, who went on to serve as Theresa May's head of communications. You have people such as Douglas Smith, who's now in Boris Johnson's number 10 unit. And in the rival group, the Young Conservatives, you had Nick Robinson, who is the former political editor of the BBC and presenter on the Today programme. So you had all these figures who, there are plenty more as well, including a number of MPs who were involved in this student group, who got to know each other at this point. Some of them, you know, weren't big fans of Burke, others were. And it was formative because, first of all, it gave him a big platform. So when he chaired this group, he was known to senior figures in the Conservative Party, including Norman Tebbit, who was the chairman of the Conservative Party at the time. And, you know, Burke would have regular conversations with these people. So it gave him a platform and notoriety within the Conservative Party. And that was where he really started to cut through as a figure and someone who became known as a future MP and a future star, basically. Mm-hmm. He would also do speeches at the annual Conservative Party conferences that would always take place. And he used to get rousing receptions he used to give these speeches where he would say, "Isn't low tax great? And isn't Margaret Thatcher brilliant?" Where, you know, he'd say the easy things and get huge standing ovations, which his friends used to take the mickey out of him for. But certainly you're right, you know, pre-becoming councillor in 1986, that five-year period of student politics and being a part of this big federation, which eventually closed, which I go into quite a lot of detail about in the book, was very formative because it gave him, as I say, notoriety within the Conservative Party. It built up a number of contacts with future MPs and leading journalists. Also, I think it's where he gained confidence. I think it's where, after a difficult school life, he grew into himself as a campaigner and as a political force and solidified his view that he wanted to become an MP.
We kind of transition from the Thatcher years and the John Major years, and then he becomes a councillor in Lambeth. Just for our American listeners, give us a sense of the political time that he becomes a councillor, but then also, kind of more importantly than that, or at least as important as that, describe Lambeth and Streatham for us, because Lambeth fundamentally is a bit of a Labour stronghold politically, isn't it? So give us an idea of what Lambeth was, Streatham, etc., and also what a councillor actually even does. Because I said there's going to be a lot of people listening to this that won't exactly know, you know, what exactly a councillor does in the UK kind of political sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So, as I mentioned earlier, with militant on the left of politics, at this, it's a bit like today, and American listeners will be able to understand this, is that politics mm-hmm. was very much split between Margaret Thatcher on the right and a bit like Ronald Reagan at the time, and then the left and the Labour Party. You had, you know, the Michael Foot years and some left wing leaders, and then you had Neil Kinnock came in who tried to push the party towards the centre, but there was this big cohort of activists who were very, you know, anti-nuclear weapons, pro-state intervention, very much anti-Thatcher. And Lambeth was, this is the, is a borough in London, in South London, which at the time was emblematic of this national divide. So Lambeth was run by a leader who actually died 2 days ago, called Ted Knight. He was called Red Ted Knight because of his political beliefs. And he opposed the Thatcher government staunchly. And he had an army of sort of left-wing activists, which the right used to call loons, you know, in a not particularly flattering light. And he refused the budget cuts that the Thatcher government had decided to impose on local councils. And as a result, found that he was fined and then banned from running for public office for 5 years, along with a number of other Labour politicians at the time. In terms of what a councillor is basically, you know, Lambeth is a area of local government in South London, and a councillor is partly responsible for helping to run that local area. It's just a subset of a wider political view. So the reason Lambeth was such a draw to John Bercow is because it was full of these so-called lefty loons, and him as a quite a confrontational right-wing politician at that time really wanted to take on and infiltrate this council, because as I say, it was led by originally Red Ted Knight, and then it was taken over by Linda Bellos, who was quite a radical herself and a quite well-known feminist. Really, she's good fun to talk to, actually. I spoke to her for the book, really enjoyed it. And so a group of conservative politicians who were called the Young Turks at the time, who came out of sort of student politics, wanted to go on to these councils where there were loads of left-wingers and just basically bait them and wind them up. And Lambeth was the perfect example for that. And it was a role that Bercow took on with aplomb. On that council was also a future MP called John Mann, who was a Labour MP. He's now a peer, member of the House of Lords. And he described Bercow as an extremist in those days. Extremist in terms of he was just very right-wing and very, you know, espousing all the things you associate with right-wingness, you know, tough on immigration, lower tax, all that kind of thing. So Lambeth was where he really sort of cut his political cloth on a more kind of public and high profile scale than he had done in student politics. But in doing so, he also, you know, Lambeth at that time was, as you say, it was fairly left wing, and in aspects of it were, I think, you know, it was quite a hostile place, obviously, for a Tory to be. And I know that him and some of his colleagues did suffer some, you know, they've received lots of death threats. They were of that ilk where confrontation was just how their modus operandi, that was how they got things done. Yeah, I'll just say there's a chapter in the book where, you know, we look at it and there are some really good stories about what was going on behind the scenes and some of the hostility that they faced.
And also, an interesting thing for me is that somebody with such stringent right-wing views, you know, that even though he's rolled them back somewhat from the case of maybe repatriating all the immigrants, you know, Lambeth was a very racially diverse borough then, much more then than now. You know, it had a very significant black population further north of the borough from Streatham, where he was, in Brixton. So, you know, he would have absolutely been going up to fight not only what he would have perceived as the loony left, but also multicultural Britain and been railing against it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you're right. I mean, the Monday Club days where he was a member of the immigration, the repatriation committee, you know, they weren't that long behind him. Though I think he would say that he dropped those views at that time. But certainly, you know, he was going into an environment where what he was saying was deeply, deeply unwelcome, which makes it all the more remarkable, really, that he decided to do it. I don't think he ever took an easy route, but I think it was just a place for a young, up-and-coming, ambitious conservative to sort of make a name for themselves and also take one for the team in a way. You know, because some of the more senior conservative politicians probably looked at Lambeth and thought, no, thank you. I want a, you know, a bit of a quieter life, and I'll go where I'm wanted as opposed to where I'm not. And but he did get elected there, so you know there were still elements of conservative voters within Lambeth, but they were certainly not in the majority.
What was his day job back then? And as soon as he left Essex, did he basically say, "I want to be a politician. I want to be a member of parliament"?
To be honest with you, he probably thought that from the age of about 8, 9. So after he left Essex, he did a year sabbatical where he was chair of the Federation of Conservative Students. His first job, which he was only in for about a year, was at a bank. And he was that was through various contacts in the Conservative Party. But even though the banking industry was obviously thriving in the 1980s, it was not one that suited John Bercow. So what he ended up working in was for a company called Roland Salisbury Casey, which is a lobbying firm. And he worked there for about 5 years. He first started working there in 88 and he left in 93, I believe. He was political lobbying. So because of his connections with the Conservative Party, he was quite a useful lobbyist. So they had various clients and they would lobby on various things, be it defence or what have you, cultural, you know, aspects. He would then lobby MPs and other people to take on board their views, and he was quite effective because, as I say, he was very well connected at these days. And but it was all, you know, it was all leading one way. His overall aim was always to become a member of parliament. So he first stood in 1987 in Motherwell South. So this is when he was still a Lambeth councillor. Now Motherwell South, to explain to the audience, was, particularly in those days, you know, Margaret Thatcher was not particularly popular in Scotland, where Motherwell South is. So it was one of those seats that he was never going to win, but by taking one for the team, he was ingratiating himself to senior figures in the party that one day they might give him, you know, a decent seat where he could get elected. So he lost there, and then in 1992 at the general election, he stood in Bristol South. Now, he was more hopeful at this point of winning a majority, because the incumbent, who's called Dawn Primorolo, who would actually go on to be a deputy speaker under Bercow down the line, she'd had a fairly small majority and looked vulnerable. As it turned out, she won with an increased majority, and Bercow roundly lost. So he tried and failed twice to get elected. And then he started working for a man called Jonathan Aitken, who was defence minister at the time, and he worked for him as a special advisor. Now, a special advisor is basically, in those days, it was more of a sort of a bag carrier, someone who obviously would provide advice on speeches and media engagements and such like. And Jonathan Aitken ended up perjuring himself over, it's quite a long-winded story, and he ended up in jail some years later. But John stayed loyal to him, which was admirable, because others, you know, because he was quite politically toxic. Obviously, a minister ends up in jail is somewhat toxic. But he stayed loyal to him as a friend, and all the while he was still applying for seats. And he came close a couple of times and fell short, until he ran for Buckingham in 1997. Now, the quite a famous story of John Bercow was that he was also in the running for a seat in Surrey Heath So two mm-hmm. very safe Conservative seats. Basically, if he got selected for either of these, he was going to end up in Parliament. Job mm-hmm. done. There's no way, even though at the subsequent election, Tony Blair romped to victory, that was always going to be a safe Tory seat. But the problem was that the final sort of hearings for each candidate were scheduled on the same night in each constituency, so one in Surrey and one in Buckingham. And his friend, Julian Lewis, who is also a Conservative MP, came up with the idea of using a helicopter. So John did his speech in Surrey Heath. He then jumped into a car. It'd been snowing that day, but regardless, the helicopter flew. So he then flew in a helicopter all the way to Buckingham, which is about, what, an hour away, I'd say, maybe an hour and a half. Anyway, landed, got into a car, raced there, got there just in time, delivered a speech, wowed the audience, and he got selected. And that was that. That was his ticket to Parliament, and he never looked back.
When Tony Blair emerged from his North London home into the morning sunshine to head for the palace, he was almost swamped by well-wishers. In a break with tradition signalling a determination to do things differently, the Blairs walked into Downing Street to be cheered by hundreds of party workers.
So it's 1997, and the British political firmament is extremely different from the early 1980s. We have Tony Blair's New Labour thing. It's a case of getting rid of, what, literally 20 years of Tory rule. Is that where we start to substantively see the change in John Bercow?
Yeah, absolutely. So he started off as he meant to go on, really. He was still mm-hmm. as combative as he was in Lambeth, or as a student. He was pretty right wing in those days. People used to tell me that he used to, you know, quote Enoch Powell still. So he was still the same John Bercow. He was also part of this coterie of Tory MPs who would stay in the Commons late, because at that point there was no timetabling. So now there's a start and an end point to when mm-hmm. a parliamentary day. In those days, there was a start point, but there wasn't necessarily an end point. So what they would do, these Tory MPs, would be to give long-winded speeches, which were tangential to the debate or discussion or bill or whatever it was at hand, and keep the Labour minister and the Labour opposite numbers up until the early hours, just to wind them up. Just to, you know, they would say they were holding them to account, but the truth is they were, you know, doing what was perfectly within the rules, but they were just filibustering, basically.
Yeah.
And Bercow, being the committed and dedicated parliamentarian, was one of this group. And it did eventually lead to what we now know as the timetabling of Parliament. So there are 10 p.m. finish points and all this kind of thing. And that was all partly due to John Bercow.
Because I must just direct one further gentle salvo at the Honourable Gentleman, a member for Cumming North, the Scottish Education Minister. I understand the Honourable Gentleman's predicament. It must be a source of quite the most stupefying embarrassment for him to have to come before the House today after the cat-handed, incompetent handling of the situation in Scotland. It is testimony, we presume, to their disbelief in equal treatment of every resident of the United Kingdom. And it is shameful. St Andrews, Dundee, Edinburgh, the other Scottish universities will demonstrate beyond peradventure the damage that the Honourable Gentleman's misjudgment has caused. The reality, Mr Deputy Speaker, in conclusion, is that the government's approach has been characterised by deception, by iniquity, and by incompetence. The losers are the students and the higher education system of this country. And for that, I hope, but I doubt, the Honourable Gentleman will have the good grace and courtesy today to apologise to this House.
Yeah.
in his early days, he was very much a man of the House of Commons. He was rarely seen outside of it, to such an extent that some people were sort of wondering about whether this guy had any life at all. But he just, you know, it was his dream to get there. So for him, you know, why waste it, I guess. But there's some really important moments in that first parliament. So the first parliament was 97 to 2001. Mm-hmm. The most significant of which was a vote on the equalizing the age of consent for homosexuals. Now, Burke had voted against this three times. The Blair government wanted to reduce, because obviously it was 16 age consent for heterosexuals, and at the time it was 18 for homosexuals. So they wanted to equalize that. Now, the Conservative Party at the time was, you know, we might well think of them now as being lowercase c conservative and traditional, cautious, whatever you want to call it. But obviously 20 years ago, even more so. And in February 2000, I think it was the fourth time of asking, Burko changed his mind. And he was going to vote in favour. And he gave this big speech where he explained why. And he set out his arguments for it about, you know, why he'd changed his mind. And he won plaudits from people he'd never won plaudits before. And I think it's a really important date in his political life, because from that moment forward, he really carried the torch for these kind of equality issues. Mm-hmm. He did it, you know, and he'd always been, to be fair, from that, you know, at that stage, in terms of race, his comments on race and equality in that respect, he'd certainly moved a long way from where he was 15 years earlier. But the plaudits that he won for this speech, which was an excellent speech, endeared into a crowd who had previously not been big fans at all. And I think he realised that it was a big Damascene conversion for him. And one thing about John Burke is when he believes in a political cause, he throws himself wholeheartedly into it. He doesn't do anything, you know, half-heartedly. Mm. He just fully commits. And from that point forward, 20 years ago, he's been true to his word on that. So that was incredibly important. And also at the same time, he got his first front bench role. So he was in the shadow education team for the Conservatives. He then went to the shadow home team. But he quickly realised that keeping to the party line was never his strong suit. And that is important for Burko, because his potential was huge as a massively gifted speaker, as someone who was well-versed in parliamentary procedure and how it operates and how politics operates. The good bits of it, the bad bits of it, he knew. Mm-hmm. He used to say it was like meat and drink to him. However, life on the front bench in government, and it's not in government, in the leadership team, did not suit him, because you have to abide by the party line. You have to, you can't, you know, publicly criticize your leader or, you know, members of that team. And he did do that because he is a very honest guy. He's very upfront and he can't keep his views to himself. Mm-hmm. As a result of that, the only real path that opened up to him to achieve the kind of influence that someone of his talents and ambition could achieve would be through the speakership. And that was a realization that was put to him by Jonathan Aiken, the person who he used to work for, the minister who went to jail I think it was about the year 2003. And from that moment on, when John realised that he wasn't going to be able to bring to bear his talents in the Conservative Party, that's when he really wholeheartedly went on that journey towards getting the speakership.
Just before we go into the speakership, he got married in 2003, and his wife had similarly gone on a political journey as well, hadn't she? She starts off a Conservative, but I think by then, she had become a member of the Labour Party, or at least she was espousing Labour Party positions. Is it fair to say that maybe she led him on the kind of political conversion as well?
This is one of the existential questions about John Burke that people talk about. You're right. Sally was they met at a Conservative student conference in 1989. They dated on and off for the next sort of 10, 15 years, only really getting back together in 2001. And they married in late 2002, it was December 2002. Sally was a dyed-in-the-wool Blairite by 1997. She fully renounced her conservative ways and came out as very much a left winger. What I would say is that, you know, the speech in February 2000 was before they got back together. So I think his beliefs in equality issues and issues on race predate them getting back together. However, I would say that Sally ignited within Burko that social liberalness and motivated him to kick it up a gear and to not release the pressure, because Burko was continually trying to change his party's stance on gay rights and you know, issues around equality. And I think she was very much a driving force in that. You know, Burko often pushes back against the idea that Sally was somehow pulling the strings. And I understand that, but I think it's not actually insulting to suggest that someone you love and care about actually you know, influenced you. That's natural, right? That's, we all have that experience, and it's a good thing. Yeah. So I think certainly she's a key figure, controversial as well. Very interesting background. They both lost their fathers young, which was a, you know, interesting formative experience that they both shared. Her coming on the scene definitely seemed to kick him into gear in terms of really pushing this agenda that we now associate with him.
So think back to the Tory party of that time. We have a whole series of leaders who are somewhat in the wake of Tony Blair. Tony Blair is this new political phenomenon who has come and radically reshaped British politics. And the Tory party is kind of floundering. We have a whole series of Tory leaders, people like Ian Duncan Smith, for example. And we end up with David Cameron. And what it seems to be that the Tory party was doing was kind of realigning itself as economically conservative. So there are the heirs of Thatcher, but becoming socially liberal, because we have David Cameron, who then, when he becomes prime minister, you know, he does in effect sign off on gay marriage. So viewed that way, John Bercow's social liberalism seems very much in lockstep with the Tory party. So what I'm still at a loss for, because I must admit, I'm putting the cart before the horse. Tories, conservatives now don't like him. But actually, ideologically, he was very much in lockstep with the party's drift and change in the early 2000s, wasn't he?
I would say that he was ahead of them. He was ahead of the curve. So, yes, you're right. He was where they ended up. He famously says that he was more pro the modernization agenda than Cameron. He got there before Cameron did. But you're right, with what Cameron was saying, the great irony of Burko is that should have been everything that he wanted and more, because they were ideologically aligned. You know, Burko was still a conservative. He still believes in low taxation and backing business and things like that. But he became socially liberal. So the Cameron modernizing agenda should have been perfect. The problem was the personalities. They hated each other. So I document throughout the book the various times that they came across each other, and it all seemed to sort of hinge on the 2005 leadership contest. So Michael Howard has stepped down, David Cameron was running, and John Burko gave this interview where he said, "We don't need another old Etonian," and he made a few personal remarks about sort of Cameron's background. Now, there might be, you know, there might be a fair critique of Cameron, and there's something that did plague him, his leadership, is the fact that he was too posh. You know, that was something that was always the problem. Was the personal nature of it meant that John Burko was never going to have a role in Cameron's team, because that was that. You know, it was the personality clashes were too big. So despite having almost completely aligned views and perceptions about where the Conservative Party needed to be, which were both based on looking at how New Labour had done so well, Tony Blair's straddling of the centre ground, and thinking that's where we need to be. Both men are smart, and both men had realised that, but they couldn't stand each other. So that's part of the reason. So Burko was, you know, Burko was ahead of the Conservative Party on many of these issues. That is for sure. But you know, it should have been a very fruitful relationship with Cameron, but because of personalities, it wasn't.
It's the late noughts, and the position of Speaker is available. Remind us, How was the position of Speaker perceived at the time? Why did he run? Who were his proponents? And where did he get his support from in Parliament?
Sure. So the Speaker's role has always been to be seen but not heard, to be impartial, to oversee the debates in the chamber and facilitate them to make sure they can operate and run. And also to be a bastion and champion of the House of Commons as an institution, both outside and sort of within it. So that's the role of a Speaker. Now, the incumbent was a man called Michael Martin, who was formerly a Labour MP. When you're a Speaker, you renounce your political affiliation. And before him, it was Betty Boothroyd, who was also a Labour politician. Now, Michael Martin was, like Burko, from very humble beginnings. He was from Glasgow, I believe, quite a tough and rough area of Glasgow. And but he was never one to grapple with executive overreach or to champion the House of Commons and stick up for backbenchers. He's a lovely man, and he passed away a couple of years ago, but he was not a particularly good Speaker of the Commons. Now, Burko decided he was going to run in about 2005 when he realised that his future in the Conservative Party was done, really. You know, there's no ladder for him to climb. There's nothing available to him because of his relationship with David Cameron. And he quickly realised that to win the speakership, he would need to rely on the votes of opposition parties, because the Conservative Party, for various reasons, not many MPs liked him at all. The reason they didn't like him was because he was very, very critical of their party. There were lots of rumours about him potentially defecting to the Labour Party. And as I said earlier, he doesn't have the best interpersonal skills. So along the way, he had alienated a few people. So he decided to, understandably, because he was trying to win a campaign, to focus on Labour MPs and MPs from other parties. So he would do things like send notes to MPs after they did speeches in the Commons, praising them for their articulation and their argument and what have you. And he very much went on something of a crusade to win over their votes. And it was one of the most effective campaigns of modern times, really, in terms of British politics. And the speakership contest came about because Michael Martin resigned after the expenses scandal hit the UK Parliament. Now, the expenses scandal, for your listeners, was obviously probably the biggest story of that period of time, wasn't it? It was massive, and it basically showed MPs had been excessive with claiming for all sorts of different things. It was very damaging to the reputation of Parliament, and Michael Martin fell on his sword as a result. So Burko, who had spent the previous 4 years laying the groundwork for a speakership campaign, his campaign was then led by a Labour MP called Martin Salter. And the rules dictated you need 12 to 15 nominees to stand for the speakerships. So that's 12 to 15 members of Parliament, three of which have to be from an opposition party. Now, the irony for Burko was that that was no problem. He just needed to try and find someone on his own side to nominate him. So he only managed to get one person, who was Charles Walker, who was a very close friend of Burko's and confidant, a very good guy, lovely guy, well thought of politician who loves an underdog, and he backed Burko. And without him, you know, he wouldn't have a nominee to get on the ballot paper. So that shows where he was in this grand scheme of things. But he got the required nominations. It was just trying to get the Conservative side of it sorted. So by the time the speakership came round, he was the front runner because he'd run this very effective campaign. And the Labour Party, who, as I mentioned earlier, had two Labour MPs elected Speaker, which was sort of it was sort of bad form that they did that, because we had this period where they were alternating. It wasn't mandatory that was the case, but to try and be fair, they were going one Conservative,
the convention.
You know, some people say that they decided, well, if they want a Conservative, let's give them a Conservative, who wasn't really actually a Tory at all at that point. The combination of this effective campaign saw him become elected on June the 22nd, 2009.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. All honourable members are, by definition, experienced campaigners. Some campaigns get off to a good start, others suffer setbacks. One of my first approaches was to a particularly distinguished colleague whom I wouldn't dream of identifying. I asked if he'd back me today.
Certainly not, Burkow. You're not just too young, you're far too young. Given that in my judgment, the speaker ought to be virtually senile.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is the result of a third ballot. 593 ballots were cast. The number of votes cast for each candidate was as follows. John Burko, 322. Yes! Yes! Sir George Young, 271. Yes! Let's make sure we sign it off properly. Mr. John Burko has secured more than 50% of the ballots cast. The question is that Mr. John Burko take the chair of this House as Speaker. As many of you are of that opinion say aye.
Aye!
Of the contrary, no. I think the ayes have it. The ayes have it. Congratulations, Mr. Speaker Burko. Yeah.
Thank you. My first pleasant duty is warmly to thank, on behalf of us all, Alan Williams for the magnificent and good-humoured way in which he's conducted this election. It's been a very long day. And those of you expecting a customarily lengthy diatribe will be sorely disappointed.
And there was talk before the speakership came up that he was going to defect to the Labour Party, wasn't there?
Yeah, so it was actually a very close run thing. So he was approached when Gordon Brown took over from Tony Blair in June 2007. Gordon wanted to secure a few defections from the Conservative Party as a boost to his premiership, an early boost. Mm-hmm. So he, through his what's called a PPS, a private parliamentary secretary, who's actually an MP, basically a bag carrier, someone who is like your ears in the House of Commons for you, who will tell you things you need to know. It was called Anne Keane, who was friends with Burko, and she approached Burko, and Ed Miliband, the future Labour leader, met with Burke to try and convince him to defect. So it really was a very close run thing. And Burke said, I'm not going to defect. I'm a conservative, but thank you. Thank you, but no thank you. But it shows how far he had travelled, that, you know, this former Thatcherite was now being approached to join the Labour Party. So it was quite remarkable, really. What they decided to do in the end was Ed Balls, who was the education secretary at the time, senior Labour MP, he got Burke to do a government review for him on speech therapy, for children, and access to speech therapy for children. It was a subject quite close to Burke's heart because his son has autism and has struggled with his speech when he was growing up. So they've got him to do this government review, which fulfilled two things. One, it was actually an excellent review. They got him to look into an area of policy that was very important to John Burke, but it was also a relatively controversial and aggravating thing for the Conservatives for to have one of their own doing a review for the government, the Labour government. So it was a clever bit of politics, really. So he did nearly defect, but Burke would say that though they approached him, it was never really a consideration that he would cross the floor of the House.
I must just say to the House, and I'm most grateful to the Prime Minister, and before we come to points of order, that for all the turbulence and discord of today's proceedings, the little baby who has been observing them has been a model of impeccable behaviour from start to finish.
So we have the coalition government in 2010, which I must admit to my eyes, or just feels like a Tory government, but technically it's a coalition one. He wasn't particularly noteworthy then, was he? Am I getting this wrong? Because, yes, I think we all knew him to be the Speaker, but he comes into his own in the later period of the Brexit kind of crisis, doesn't he? So tell us about that period.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's partly, obviously, because of what they were just, you know, Brexit was such a huge issue, and also because it was a minority government at the time. The Commons was much stronger, whereas in the coalition years, even though it was a hung parliament, the combination of the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives together gave them a big majority in the House of Commons, so they could get stuff through relatively uncontroversially. Not everything, obviously. But it was, you know, in terms of that, the Speaker's influence was not as strong as it was going to be, you know, in the latter years that you refer to. But he was still, you know, he was still a fixture. And the first thing that Burke started doing was introducing or just using a lot more what we call urgent questions, which is because there's scheduled parliamentary business where at 2:30 you're going to talk about defence, at 3:30 you'll talk about health and etc. But there's also capacity to have a minister come in to address questions on the subject of a day, and that's what's called an urgent question. Now, before, they'd not really been used, only really in extreme circumstances. But with Burke, if it was a big, important news story of the day, he would award an urgent question. An MP has to ask for it for it to be awarded. He can't just conjure it up himself. But and so as a result of that, news was broken in the House of Commons, and that hadn't happened for ages. So important developments were announced to the House of Commons. And if there was a big story, so, you know, if we're taking you back a bit, but big stories at the time were like the takeover of Sky B. You had the phone hacking scandal, you know, I'm really taking you back now. But obviously these were huge stories at the time. And Burke made sure that MPs got to ask the questions that they needed to ask. So in that regard, he made a name for himself as someone who kind of really rejuvenated the House of Commons as a forum of debate and scrutiny, which, as I say, under Michael Martin, it really wasn't. You know, even though you had the Iraq War and stuff like that, under his tenure, you know, regularly you'd see on the broadcasters, the BBC and Sky, cutting to the House, you know, live footage from the House of Commons, and that's largely due to Burke, to be honest with you. He also became known in those years for his some of his reprimands from the chair. You know, he could put down MPs with some curt comments and some nice articulation. So he did gain notoriety for that regard. And in doing so, his relationship with Cameron continued to sour to the point where they tried to get rid of him in 2015. I don't know if we'll come on to talk about that. But yeah, certainly he, you know, during those 5 years, also behind the scenes, he was making quite a lot of changes. So he introduced a nursery where a bar used to be. He introduced the education centre. He was instrumental in the rollout of a parliamentary studies module that went to universities across the UK. So he was doing lots of advocacy work on the side. So he, you know, he was reforming behind the scenes and reforming in front of the camera as well, by awarding urgent questions. In doing so, he was also accumulating his fair share of detractors because, you know, Burko was an amazing reformer, but he was quite aggressive in how he went about it. And this is when various incidences of alleged bullying took place. Mm-hmm. So it was a very important time, even though perhaps in the public consciousness, he was still a bit part player compared to what would come after the coalition years. But I would say, you know, the highlight was certainly his reawakening of the House of Commons.
He's strengthening the role of the backbenchers and he's in effect putting Parliament central in the British political system in that Parliament is sovereign.
The 2015 British election has thrown up a stunning result that confounded the opinion polls and returned David Cameron and his Conservatives to power, alone. Their coalition partners were destroyed and the UKIP challenge failed to materialise. The main opposition Labour Party suffered a bloodbath in Scotland, where English-based parties collapsed.
And of course, it means bringing together the different nations of our United Kingdom. I have always believed in governing with respect. In this Parliament, I will stay true to my word and implement as fast as I can the devolution that all parties agreed for Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland.
Many accused Cameron during the campaign of scaremongering that Scots MPs would run the country alongside Labour.
We can make Britain a place where a good life is in reach for everyone who is willing to work and do the right thing. And yes, we will deliver that in-out referendum on our future in Europe.
Despite UKIP's poor showing and sealing five more years in power, this time without any inconvenient partner, Cameron felt obliged to raise Europe in his victory speech, instead of quietly letting the issue die. These final results mark the end of the domestic political war. Cameron now appears determined to open his European front, setting the scene for a potentially divisive 18 months before a referendum.
The Tory party win a surprising majority, and a part of that compact, Cameron says to the right wing of the Tory party that we'll have a vote on leaving the European Union. Nobody thinks that that when this vote then comes around that it's ever going to be passed, this referendum. And we have Theresa May, who then becomes a prime minister because Cameron steps on his sword after that referendum is lost. We have Theresa May, who is presiding over our negotiated exit from the European Union. And all of a sudden, Parliament is incredibly important because there's another election. She calls it a snap election, thinking that she'll get a thumping majority in the House of Commons so she can ram home whatever she wants to do with Brexit. But actually, she doesn't have that majority. All of a sudden, John Bercow is some kind of power broker almost. Let's go through that period, because as you said at the start, American listeners of this podcast will know him because of his performance during that period. And he was seen as the hero, really, for Remainers in and outside of the United Kingdom. So I've done the setup. So Theresa May is in office, but not necessarily in power. Discuss.
I think an important place to start is that we haven't discussed it yet, but John Bercow was a proper Eurosceptic. He was a real Eurosceptic. When he was a student, he used to take on his lecturers over the UK's membership of the Common Market when he was an MP. He used to call for a referendum on membership of the European Union, staunch opponent of the euro. I was told that he was a member of the ERG. You know, the ERG is the European Research Group, which was quite a powerful backbench force. It was a different sort of entity 20 years ago than what we know it to be now. But yeah, he was on the interview for a new position on the ERG. I spoke to someone who interviewed for it. So that's just another. It's important to know that because obviously by the time the referendum came around, he had changed his views. Now, an important date in this is the 3rd of February 2017. So Theresa May, as you say, she's in power. John Bercow goes to the University of Reading and he reveals that he voted to remain. Now, that was a controversial thing to have done. Now, notwithstanding your views on Brexit and what have you, the speaker is supposed to be
neutral
and not pronounce on how they voted it on anything or how they would vote. So that was a huge gamble. That was a big gamble for him. And it, you know, those on the other side of the debate to himself would use that as evidence of bias subsequently. But notwithstanding that, so you're right. So Theresa May goes to the polls. She gets somewhat humiliated, comes back, has to sign a confidence and supply agreement with the DUP to sort of prop up a government. Now, what happens then? So Bercow is faced with a government who act as if they are in a majority government, where they feel they have a right to get their business through, where they feel that the House of Commons is something of a nuisance, a bit of a buggerance. And then they come up against Bercow, who believes the opposite of all of that. Now, in the initial approach of the Theresa May government to Brexit, Parliament was very much secondary. So she wanted the right for the government to be able to unilaterally trigger Article 50, which is the 2-year process by which a country leaves the European Union. She didn't want Parliament to have a say. She gave her Lancaster House speech where she announced that the UK would be leaving the single market. She did that outside of Parliament, not to Parliament, as should be the case. So over an 18-month period, at least, the government had acted in a way that frankly wound Bercow up and wound up a number of people who value the UK's Parliament, you know, democratic system and use of parliamentary democracy. So that's the backdrop to everything that happened, because the truth is, you know, even if you're a leaver, I think you can recognize that to be true, that, you know, MPs weren't even going to be given a vote on the divorce deal that went through in January of this year. They weren't even going to be given a say on that under the original plans of the Theresa May government. So given John Bercow's predisposition to stand up for Parliament and the rights of backbenchers, it created, fostered this environment for this almighty and very famous row, whereby Bercow took it upon himself to see it that the government were very much held to account. Now, the crucial point, as you will know, will be, is around December 2018. So Theresa May has, she's got her deal now. It was agreed in November 2018. Over the previous couple of years, there've been lots of rows about Parliament and, you know, the government's negotiating strategy and all this kind of stuff. And Theresa May was supposed to, she scheduled the first vote on the deal for the 10th of December 2018. And then when she realized she was about to lose it very badly, delayed it. Now, Bercow was furious because it was being scheduled in parliamentary time. MPs had not been given a vote on whether to delay it or not. The whole thing was just, you know, a cock up. A month later was supposed to be the first meaningful vote, what we call the meaningful vote, which was a vote on the deal. And Bercow awarded basically the same motion carried forward with all the same debate timetabling. And this is going to get slightly wonkish, but if you bear with me. And normally you can't amend this agreed government motion, which sets out the way in which the debate is going to run and the timings and everything. But Dominic Grieve, who was the former Attorney General, Conservative MP and anti-Brexit, you know, pro-Remain campaigner, put forward an amendment to this motion, even though he, you know, he told me he didn't think he would get it. You know, he didn't think Burko would say, yes, MPs can vote on this amendment, which I'll go into in a second. But Burko, seemingly in breach of what had been convention to this point, did allow this government motion to be amended. And this caused the most almighty row, because he had seemingly not followed the rules, quote unquote rules, because they're not really rules, they're sort of interpretations of existing decisions made previously. And that was where he really became known, not just nationally, but internationally, because that was Burko making a decision to allow the House of Commons to express its view.
Speaking to Amendment 7 in the name of my honourable friends, myself, and indeed other honourable members, I'm conscious that this amendment has taken on a life of its own. When this committee stage of the bill started, it was my intention, and I hope one that I have observed and honoured throughout, that I would try to approach the amendments I tabled in the spirit which they are intended, which is to try to improve difficult legislation where I entirely recognise that the government faces many challenges. Brexit is full of risk, full of complexity, legal and otherwise, and the government is entitled to my support, wherever possible, to carry Brexit out as smoothly as possible and with the least impact on the well-being of the citizens of our country. That has been my aim throughout.
The ayes to the right, 309. The noes to the left, 305.
So the amendment was for Theresa May to report back to the House of Commons within 3 days of losing a vote on her deal what she would do next. And it allowed the series of events whereby MPs could influence the agenda. And MPs supported this amendment. They voted for it. Now, his opponents would say that he just set up in flames centuries of precedent and rules around parliamentary procedure and how these things work. What I would say, and what I'm sure I imagine you would say as well, was that he allowed the House to express its will. It supported this amendment, which became known as the Grieve Amendment, and gave MPs the opportunity to actually influence the debate and come to a decision. And that was really the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of the antagonism between Burko and the government. So we're now in January 2019. That was when he really sort of took a stand and said, you might think this is going to work in this way and that I'm going to behave in this way. Actually, no, this is how it's going to go. I'm going to facilitate the House of Commons and backbenchers, make sure that they can have a say. It's not solely at your discretion, Theresa May. You're not in the majority in this parliament. And this issue needs to be debated by MPs. So that had been building for 2 years, but that was the big moment where he broke with convention and split opinion, but ultimately did his best to allow the House of Commons to express its view.
Was John Burko basically just better at understanding Erskine May, you know, the rules and procedures of Parliament, just better than the government? And the other question to ask is, how much was he truly led by people like Dominic Grieve? Or was there basically some kind of cabal of Remainers of which he was a part of?
In terms of Erskine May, I would say he, you know, as Erskine May should be interpreted, half the things that Burko did in that final 12 months shouldn't have happened. But he was right on the wider point that these were unprecedented times. And occasionally in history, precedent has to be departed from. And occasionally, conventions, normalities and traditions need to be moved on. And he was not the only person guilty of doing things that were unconventional. You know, if you remember, Theresa May ended up losing 3 meaningful votes, which in normal times would be a vote of confidence in a government. Yeah. You know, if you know, you just resign if you lost one of those. You know, Geoffrey Cox, the Attorney General, was found in contempt of Parliament. In normal times, he would resign. The Labour Party and other opposition parties voted against an election because it was more, initially they kept voting against having an election because it was more beneficial to actually keep that current parliament going and make sure the government was held to account on Brexit. Again, no one had ever heard of that before, of an opposition party going, you know what, no, we don't want an election. We don't want to get rid of you. So that whole period of time was rife with people and organizations going against what was usually the done thing. And John Bercow just happened to be one of them. So it wasn't necessarily having a greater sort of knowledge of Erskine May. It was more a greater understanding, perhaps, of the slightly bigger picture that Parliament needed to be the focal point for these things. You know, the point I make in the book is that the Brexit impasse did continue. But that's not Bercow's fault. Some people say, well, Bercow was the blockage and Bercow was the one who exacerbated this complete sort of paralysis in Parliament. But it's not true. It's not his fault that MPs just couldn't decide what they were for. They were given plenty of opportunities to either agree to Theresa May's deal, to back a second referendum, to back a Norway-style Brexit or whatever it might have been. They were given lots of opportunities by Bercow to do that, and they didn't. So that's not his fault. You know, that's for them to think about. As for the cabal of Remainers, look, you know, Dominic Grieve, he did approach Bercow about this amendment, but nothing untoward happened. And people like Hilary Benn as well spoke to Bercow. But that's not in and of itself in any way a conspiracy, because the speaker is available to MPs to chat and to talk things through. I don't think there is a Remainer conspiracy of the kind that some people want there to be with John Bercow. I think that... my personal view is that, given he said that Brexit, after he left the speakership, he said Brexit was the biggest post-war mistake the UK's ever made. I do think he was biased on the issue of Brexit. However, and I say that, you know, I voted Remain, so I'm not. I just think he was biased. But equally, I think there wasn't a conspiracy where people were trying to block Brexit and there was a WhatsApp group and all this kind of stuff that perhaps people want there to be. I do think he was trying to do his best to allow the House of Commons to have its say. And it would have been damning if he had kept allowing the House of Commons to vote on having a second referendum and MPs kept rejecting it. You know, half the time the House of Commons agreed to the amendments that he awarded, or they voted for the Grieve Amendment. They voted in these emergency debates for the Benn Act and all these kinds of things. So he had an ear for what the House of Commons wanted. My gripe with Bercow on this issue is that I just wish he didn't then mouth off about Brexit so much, because it makes it harder for me to defend him, because, you know, against people who have, you know, preconceptions about him. Because he doesn't need to say his views. If he kept them to us, if he didn't say that he voted to remain and just behaved in this way as he did, I think that would be much more powerful. That's my personal opinion. But,
you know, why do you think he has been so vociferous, and why do you think he gave that speech at Reading?
Well, it's one of those questions that I ask myself every day, and fortunately, I think part of it, he does like the limelight. And there's there can be no denying that when someone speaks and acts in the way that he does enjoy some of the attention.
Certainly, momentous times for Britain and for the world. I didn't anticipate the way events would turn. I don't say this in any spirit of resentment or complaint. That would be completely inappropriate. But politicians usually tell you about when they were right, and I am very happy to admit to you when I was wrong. My wife and I had dinner in, I think, something like March of last year with friends of ours, Michael Levy, Lord Levy, and his wife Gilda, in a restaurant in central London. And at one point, Michael Levy turned to me and said, "Well, John, what's going to happen in the EU referendum and the presidential election?" And I said, "Oh, Michael, the British people will vote to remain and Hillary will be the next president. And he said to me, John, I want both of those things and I expect neither. And he was convinced that the public would rebel against the political establishment and vote to withdraw from the EU, partly because he thought there was a very heavy concern, a very strong and dominant concern about migration, which he didn't share, but he thought that it would be to the fore, and I think the evidence is that proved to be true. And as far as the presidential election was concerned, he thought, well, like me, he thought Hillary would make a good president, but he thought she was incurably unpopular and just wouldn't command support, and that proved to be true. So I'm very conscious that, you know, I'm in office at a momentous time. I do believe in respecting the will of the electorate. I mean, Parliament can do what it likes, but, and this may not be popular with some people in this audience, personally, I voted to remain. I thought it was better to stay in the European Union than not, partly for economic reasons, being part of a big trade bloc, and partly because I think we're in a world of power blocks, and I think for all the weaknesses and deficiencies of the European Union, it's better to be part of that big power bloc in the world than thinking that you can act as effectively on your own. And there are a lot of supranational and multilateral and global challenges which I think we're better placed to try to address as part of a wider group. And so I voted to remain.
He knows his onions, Burko. He's a smart cookie. And he knows his historical precedents. And he would have known when he revealed that he voted to remain that he was taking quite a risk. I think part of it might have been motivated by...
Do you think what he did that? Because at that point, it really was a Remain Parliament, even though Article 50 has been, you know, voted for. But basically, it's a Remain Parliament, isn't it? And it was just a way of him basically saying, look, we can exit the European Union with on the most favourable terms for this Remain Parliament. So, and I'm going to be the tip of that spear.
I think that there's merit in that argument. I think there is. I think it also, you know, in revealing that he voted to remain and acting as he did endear himself to a part of the establishment. I hate that word. You know, let's call it that. That perhaps he had not been endeared to before. And lots, you know, it was very interesting. Lots of people, well, you know, would say, "Oh, I didn't like John Burke. I thought he was a pain in the ass." But then actually, I back him. You know, I love him because of what he did on Brexit. I think there was some of that going on. I think he is, you know, as we've channeled quite well in this conversation, he's confrontational. He's not shy of confrontation. So I think part of it was a calculated risk, just like, I know this will cause controversy, but I can defend, you know, because the thing is, he's such a good, so good at arguing and defending himself and getting his point across that, you know, he can sort of navigate any situation he gets himself into and justify it. I think part of it is just a propensity to take up the limelight, and it's my big regret about him in this regard is that I just think he would go down, his legacy would be stronger for having wound in his views and acted in the same way, and it would have been a more kind of easier to fend and almost a more noble pursuit of parliamentary democracy and the values and tenets of everything that comes with that and the principle that backbenchers have a right to be heard, as opposed to the furthering of John Burko's political career and ambitions.
Towards the end of that last parliament, he knew that he was part of the reason why there was gubbings in the works, wasn't he? So he basically announced that he was going to resign, not stand for election again, sorry, which is fundamentally the same thing. But so he did realise that he was a part, a small but important part of the problem with that parliament in the end, didn't he? And that's putting the allegations of bullying to one side, which kind of surfaced just before that and stuff, or really came out into the public light.
Yeah, I think, well, the thing with him was that he had first of all, pledged to serve for 9 years, and he was about 10 and a half into, having been Speaker. So there was that. The main factor was that the Conservatives said they would stand against him in Buckingham. So usually sitting Speakers are not challenged by the larger parties. Smaller parties tend to have a pot, people like UKIP and stuff, but not Labour or the Lib Dems or Conservatives. And the Conservatives announced on the 8th of September 2019 that they would stand against Burko at any election. And obviously at that point, they were trying to call an election, but they couldn't get it from that point. So if the Conservatives stood against him, he would have lost his seat, because no matter how popular an individual is, you know, it's been proven, you know, at that election that independents just struggle against the might of a party machine. So he would not have been able to go out on his own terms, is the truth. But as for the Remainer Parliament, I mean, he probably thought, he said he was gutted when they actually gave in to the election. He wanted to pass on the baton to a speaker elected by that particular parliament who could continue his work on Brexit. But, you know, the Lib Dems and others wanted an election, and they're paying the price for that now. So I think he'd run out of road. You know, he'd been there a year longer than he said he would serve. The Conservatives were emboldened to stand against him. He couldn't go out on his own terms any other way now. He'd done as much as he could. And he was the longest serving speaker since the Second World War. So in that regard, he'd had his fill. He'd served his time, and he'd done everything he could. I think it was the right time for him to depart the scenes.
I would like to thank the Prime Minister and colleagues for their kind and generous personal remarks, which are greatly appreciated. And in particular, again, I want to thank my wife, Sally, and our three children, Oliver, Freddie and Jemima, for the support, stoicism and fortitude which they've displayed through thick and thin over the last decade. I'll never forget it, and I'll always be grateful for it.
Although we may disagree about some of the legislative innovations that you have favoured, there is no doubt in my mind that you have been a great servant of this Parliament and of this House of Commons. You have modernised, you have widened access, you have cared for the needs of those with disabilities, and you have cared so deeply for the rights of backbenchers that you've done more than anyone since Stephen Hawking to stretch time in this particular session. And as we come to the end of what must be the longest retirement since Frank Sinatra, Mr. Speaker, I'm sure the whole House will want to join me in thanking you and hoping that you enjoy in your retirement the soothing medicament that you have so often described for the rest of us.
What's going to be his legacy? Is he going to go down as a great parliamentarian? Is he going to go down as somebody who reawakened the power of Parliament against the executive, et cetera, et cetera? If somebody's updating your biography of him in 2120, what are they going to say about John Burko?
I think lots of what you say will feature, but what you can't ignore is a lot of what happened behind the scenes as well. So I think he was certainly a great reformer. He was a great defender of fundamental rights in our democracy, which we hold dear, at a time where our constitution and the very fabric of the country at that point was under a lot of pressure. Given everything we're experiencing at the moment with coronavirus, it does seem to put some of that into perspective, but not for generations have we faced such a contentious time in our politics. So that's is part of it. And yes, he was a great parliamentarian. He's one of the most talented of his generation, which included, by the way, you know, in 1997, Theresa May came in, Philip Hammond, Oliver Letwin, lots of senior Conservative politicians, of whom John Burko was one and was one of the most talented. So undoubtedly a highly proficient and skilled politician. But he was also quite an aggressive, relatively hostile and difficult person who did quite a lot of collateral damage along the way. And there are people who work in the House of Commons who are not big fans of John Bercow, and I think that is an important part of the picture, because you know, it can be a great. The best politicians know that to be a great reformer and to achieve change, you need to be determined to a certain extent. You need to be ruthless, but you don't need to treat people badly. And I think that often Bercow did. That line was blurred. And I appreciate, you know, that might sound controversial. I think, you know, in the book, lots of that is detailed in quite a lot of the chapters. So I think you have to factor that into the overall picture. But one thing's for sure is we won't forget him in a hurry.
What next for you, sir? Tell us what you're doing at the moment. Coronavirus emergencies accepted. What's next?
Well, I think I'm going to try and just relax a little bit because I've been working full time for the House magazine. The school editor there, whilst also writing the book. So it's been a fairly full-on 6 months or so for me. So I'm going to just unwind for a couple of weeks. I'm still, you know, still doing the House magazine, still interviewing politicians. We're writing lots of features, obviously, about the coronavirus and the lack of global leadership. That's something I'm looking at the moment. And then in the future, I'd love to get back into book writing again. I just need to find someone who is as fascinating and stimulating as John Bercow.
He does feel almost like a politician because he was so much a parliamentarian as opposed to, you know, a government minister. He does feel like he's almost from a different age, from a bygone age in that regard. There was somebody who was very much kind of steeped in, as you said, you know, when he comes into parliament in 97, he's a filibuster. He knows about all the arcane rules of how to, you know, slow legislation and just to mess the works up, basically, but very much pursuing the procedure of the House. And viewed that way, for me, almost harkens back to some kind of 19th century politician who was about the clubbability and about the rules of Parliament. So it's almost ironic that even though he feels very much like a parliamentarian, he didn't have those soft skills to be able actually to be clubbable in that regard, you know, having a drink at the right bar with the right junior minister at the right time and just helping their passage in the upper echelons of the Tory party or within Parliament in the way of which Parliament has worked. It, very much in that way, he's very much a contradictory character.
I completely agree with you. He there are a few people you meet in life who when you ask them at the age of 10 or 11, what do you want to do? And they might turn around to you and say, I want to be an MP. And they're always the ones that you're like, gosh, you know, who would admit that? But he would have been.
William Hague.
No,
he is another weirdo. He said the same thing, didn't he?
yeah, that's true. But you're right. He absolutely knew the fundamentals of politics, how Parliament operates. He was ready to go from the first day he became an MP. Some people take years to acclimatize and get used to how it runs. He was ready to go. But you're right that actually one of the more subtle sides of politics is the human interactions and relationship building qualities that you need to succeed. And some people can get there from sheer determination and sort of brute force, and that was probably Bercow. Other people can get there from networking in a slightly cynical way. I think, you know, he wasn't shy of networking. The issue often was just building up a rapport with the people that he needed to in his early years in conservative politics anyway. But he got more adept at that, and that was why he won the speakership. So, and that was why he was able to remain in place for a long time, because he did eventually learn. But, you know, he learned how to secure those relationships. But when he came in, he didn't. And it was something that didn't come naturally to him and has never come naturally to him throughout his life. As I say, interpersonal skills-wise, he's not blessed. But he's blessed with a strategic mind and a gift of articulation, unlike many or any of his contemporaries.
Perfect end.
One thing I found really sad, whatever you think about Brexit, the one thing I have found really shocking and upsetting over the last 7 months is the way that, following the referendum, a proportion of the electorate felt they had the license to be racist and abusive and vicious and threatening. I honestly thought the days when I would see slogans daubed on walls saying words to the effect, fuck off Polish scum, and that sort of thing, I thought those days were gone. And they've been really shocking and very upsetting experiences, not just for me, but for, I think, a lot of other people in Parliament around the country, and a lot of people across the country, don't underestimate it, are very frightened by the atmosphere in parts of the country. And I think the media have some responsibility in this matter to weigh their words in what they say. And to be honest, I don't care what people say about political correctness. Political correctness has a good feature to it, which is respect for other people and a concern for the impact of what you say on how other people feel. And in my view, the equality legislation of recent decades on race and on gender and on sexuality has been a very positive thing for Britain. Britain is a more civilised, a more humane, a more decent society, in my opinion, than it was 20 years ago.
If people want to find you on social media, Sebastian, how can they do that?
I'm on Twitter at Seb Whale. I'm also on Instagram at the same name, so it's SEBWHALE.
And remind us the name of the book.
It's Call to Order, biography of John Bercow. It's published by Bite Back. You can get it more or less anywhere that you get your books, and usually.
Sebastian, well, thank you for coming on to Mid-Atlantic and explaining and showing us the political journey of John Bercow.
Thank you.
Boom! Done it.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.